So, Sue Blackmore, thank you very much for joining me today. And first of all, let's kick off by talking about your background, which I describe a little bit in the book. How did you get into all these weird things?
I think it goes back to when I read a book by Rene Haynes about psychic powers when I was about 16 on holiday. That's probably why, when I got to Oxford in 1970, where I was studying physiology and psychology, I thought I might try and join the Psychical Research Society. I joined loads of things, but I joined that. And it turned out there was only one surviving member from the year before. And he was, I rather fancied him, he was a second year young man. And he said, would I help him start the society up again? And that seemed rather fun. So I ended up very quickly running the Psychical Research Society and inviting witches and druids and psychics and mediums and spiritualists and all sorts of different people to come and give us lectures. And we started doing experiments and messing around with the Ouija board and all sorts of things like that. And that was really the beginning.
And at that point, would you describe yourself as a believer, as a skeptic, agnostic? Where would you put yourself?
I would say at the beginning, just a kind of wide open, wow, isn't the world fascinating, isn't it exciting learning all these things? Until, towards the end of my first term, I had the most extraordinary out-of-the-body experience. Well, I call it an out-of-the-body experience, but at the time I called it astral projection. Then when the term near-death experience was invented a few years later, I thought, oh, it's all the things they said in that. And then when I began learning about mystical experiences later, I thought, oh, actually, it was a mystical experience. But whatever you like to call it, that extraordinary experience turned me then into a believer in all sorts of things. I made irrational leaps from a genuine, mind-changing, amazing experience. I leapt in all kinds of illogical ways to believe in all kinds of things.
And let's talk through that experience then. What was the basis of it?
The basis of it was late at night, I was very tired, and I think that's probably relevant. We'd been having a Ouija board session all evening, which I do not recommend. I mean, I don't believe you call up spirits, but it can still be psychologically dangerous. And we'd been doing that for some hours, and it gets you into a sort of kind of a bit slightly weird state. I went to a friend's room after this, quite late at night, smoked a joint, which I did frequently in those days, and I, honestly, that evening I didn't have very much because I was feeling quite tired and had to get up for 9 o'clock lectures. And I was sitting on the floor listening to music, maybe Grateful Dead or something, Pink Floyd maybe, I don't know, some kind of nice trancey sort of music, and I was going down a tunnel. I didn't know anything about tunnels and near death and all that in those days. I just found myself going down a tunnel of leaves, as it were, like in a wood or something, towards a bright light. And as I was zooming towards this bright light, going, wow, this is incredible, ah, you know, with the music going away, one of my friends said, do you want some coffee? And I couldn't answer, and I was, oh, I like, ah. And then my other friend, there were three of us there, said, where are you, Sue? Which is a jolly strange question to ask. But it was the right question to ask because I went, oh, well, where am I? And began to kind of think, where am I? I thought, well, I'm in Vicky's room. It looks like this, that, and the other. And there I was looking down from the ceiling. That's how it seemed. Absolutely vivid. There was the room in all its detail. There were the three of us. And I was looking down at my own body sitting there and the mouth opening and shutting and saying, I'm on the ceiling.
So you saw yourself speaking?
Yes. And that was okay. Very, very weird. And remember then, mobile phones hadn't been invented, but it was kind of like, you know, we seem quite normal now. It was as though I was sort of talking up there, but it was coming out down there, you know, that sort of feeling. But very quickly then, Kevin said to me, well, can you go out of the roof? Can you go, you know? And I started to set off and travel, and that was just the beginning of over 2 hours of the most extraordinary experiences.
And I think that's quite unusual for OB to last that long, isn't it?
Very unusual. I've done lots of surveys of OBE subs. Obviously, I became fascinated by it. I did lots of surveys later. Typically, they last, you know, a minute or two is quite long. Very often, they're a few seconds. People sort of have this impression that they're looking down on themselves and very often go, and sort of panic, and that's the end of it. Some last a few minutes. Very, very rarely do they last more than, say, 5 minutes.
And what did you do for that 2 hours? You could have gone anywhere, I'm thinking. I mean, were you in charge of where you were going, or were you being taken somewhere?
To begin with, I felt in charge of where I was going. And being a kind of scientist by nature, I was thinking, well, where can I go so that we can check that this is real? And I decided to go to New York. But that was ridiculous, because, of course, I saw kind of impression of what I would expect in New York, and there's no way of checking anything. And I came back, and I looked at the roofs of Oxford and the gutters and everything, which I was able to check the next day. And I saw old-fashioned iron gutters, and the next morning I discovered they were plastic, white ones. But, you know, that was the next day, or the day after when I'd recovered. I then went off to France. I mean, I went to all sorts of places, trying to think, well, I must go and look at places, and then I can check later. But, you know, I hadn't set up an experiment in advance, and I didn't do anything that would really allow any definite checks. But the longer it went on, you asked a very interesting question there. Was I in charge or was I being taken? I would say later I was being taken. Some very strange things began to happen. I lost the sense of being very clearly another me out of my body, and I became a sort of flat sheet floating on the water for a while, and then the waves were really upsetting, and then I tried to climb up a cliff to get out of the sea, and I kept changing shape. I lost any steadiness of shape or size, and I was worried by that, and at some point I tried to get back, and I couldn't get back because I overshot. I went too small. I mean, I got back, as it were, and it's all becoming right. At the beginning it was absolutely kind of normal looking, and then it became, later on, the ordinary sense of self broke down, but so did the ordinary sense of what I was looking at. So I came back, saw this body sitting there in what looked like the room in Oxford, you know, but I couldn't get back inside. I mean, I went too small. So then I thought, well, I've got to get bigger and be the right sizes. It sounds ludicrous now, but I'm only just trying to honestly report to you what happened. Then I started to get bigger and bigger. And that's when it became more like a mystical experience, because ultimately time and space disappeared in the normal sense we think of them. And all kinds of lessons seem to be being taught to me, even more difficult to describe than the earlier part.
We'll talk about sort of what might have been going on inside your brain later on, but in terms of the impact that had on you at the time, what was the impact?
Oh, the impact was dramatic. I mean, I look back and I think, well, I understand why I jumped to all these conclusions. It was dramatic because the experience had seemed more real, more vivid, and more important than anything in ordinary life. And people often say this about near-death or mystical experiences. And therefore, I desperately wanted to understand what was going on. It conflicted completely with everything I was learning in my degree. I mean, remember in the early 1970s, a psychology degree was mostly about rats learning in mazes, and it was very, very mechanistic. We didn't understand very much about the brain at all. There were no brain scanners. So I had no kind of connection between these extraordinary experiences and what I was learning about the brain and the mind in my degree. And I simply jumped to the conclusion that this proved that I had or was a soul or a spirit or an astral body, that this astral body was able to leave the physical and manage without it, forgetting, of course, that the physical body was getting on perfectly fine, still alive back in the room, you know. But, you know, I kind of thought, it doesn't need the body, therefore it can survive death. Therefore, lots of the stuff that I'd read about theosophy and astral planes and etheric bodies and stuff was true, that there must be telepathy and clairvoyance and precognition and psychokinesis, all these things must be true. I just sort of lumped them all together and thought, well, you know, all my lecturers are wrong and I know the truth and I'm going to prove it to them. And from then on, I was absolutely committed, whatever else I did, and I worked hard for my degree as well, that I was going to prove to the world that, you know, there's more in your philosophy, there are other worlds, and so on.
And some of that work you went on to do, some of the subsequent research, did focus on OBEs. And what's your sort of viewpoint on them now? What do you think is going on? What do you think was going on in your head when you had that first weird experience?
I didn't immediately start work on OBEs. It seemed too far out. It was far out enough to do work on telepathy and clairvoyance, which is what I did for some years. But I did eventually then come back to work on OBEs. I'll answer that in two parts, really. In the late 70s, early 80s, when I began working on OBEs again and interviewing people who'd had them and studying the research on near-death experiences, I developed a sort of basic psychological theory, which really is saying, where we think we are normally, i.e. we feel as though we're inside our head looking out, that is just a construction. There isn't really somebody in the head looking out. If there's a brain and a body constructing the idea of a self in there. What happens in an out-of-the-body experience is that we're unable to construct that mental image, that idea of a self that's inside the head, either because we haven't got enough sensory input or because we've got some kind of problem with brain processing, you know, an anoxia or shock or some hormone change or something. For whatever reason, we kind of cast around, as it were, where am I, who am I, what's going on, try to make sense of the world. And bird's eye views, looking down from above, are actually very common. Many people dream in bird's eye views. We use them in imagination. Even people who live in remote islands and have never seen photographs can read bird's eye view photographs and maps and things. It's very natural, and it's a kind of simplification. So I hypothesized then that that's what's happening. We're rebuilding a model of self as though it's outside looking down, just as a way of coping. And when normality is restored, we get our eyes are open, we feel things again, then we immediately flip back to the normal construction, which is the idea of self inside that brain. Now, I developed that theory to some extent, and other people, you know, joined in and did argued and whatever. I did a few studies, for example, showing that people who have OBEs are more likely to dream in bird's eye views. They're better at switching views and imagery, and all that seemed encouraging, but it wasn't a really satisfactory theory. And then I kind of did other things, because nothing was happening in the world of OBE research, until finally, a few years ago, in the 21st century, things began to change. And first, a lab in Switzerland discovered a particular spot at the temporoparietal junction in the right hemisphere of the brain, where if it's stimulated, you can produce out-of-body experiences. Lots of other work has now come together to show that what seems to be happening is that particular part of the brain which coordinates your body image, constructs your sense of where your limbs are, where you are, where your head is, puts it all together with all the sensory input. That bit needs to be disturbed, and then you'll have an out-of-the-body experience. And it is indeed a disruption of one's body image.
And as you look back now on that weird experience you had, can you reinterpret it in that way, or does it still feel somehow magical?
Well, depending what you mean by magical, it definitely still feels magical, yes. I mean, I can still, all this time later, how long was it, 41 years, I can still remember something of the quality, extraordinary quality of it. But I would interpret it in very different ways now. I would say the beginning of it was a classic out-of-the-body experience, produced probably by a combination of tiredness, the drug, what we've been doing, all of those things, which is why I mention them, which are all things which can disrupt your firm sense of your body image and where you are. And that was the beginning of it. But then I would say that because I was able to stay in that state and not drop out of it, mainly because I had Kevin encouraging me and saying, and what next? And go on, tell me more, and so on. And therefore I wasn't frightened and I kept going. I would say that the normal illusory sense of self began to dissipate. And what was happening really was perhaps seeing the world more truly as it is, instead of our normal illusory view or constructed view that I am separate from the rest of the world. I'm sitting in here inside my head looking out, and there's the world out there, and I am conscious, and this is what I'm conscious of, that dualist view. All of that disintegrated, went away, leaving a monist view in which I am the universe, everything is one, everything is interconnected, there is no free will, I don't do anything, because I am not separate from all the things that happen. And I honestly think that it was a wonderful gift to be allowed to have that happen and to be able to have a completely different way of understanding the world, which subsequently I've done years and years and years of meditation practice, and I think that is, in Zen at least, which is the tradition that I'm trained in, is very similar to the kinds of changes that happen when you meditate for a long time.
Which brings me on to my next question, was in terms of trying to induce an OBE, there's some the exercises in the book, and I know you've written about some of those activities as well. Do you think people, if they work hard enough, can sort of produce them at will?
It's very difficult. I've tried, as you say, I've tried lots of methods, and I've tried them with other groups of friends and student groups and so on. And very few people actually manage to induce an out-of-body experience deliberately. It can be done, but it's very difficult. There are sort of workshops and things you can go on that claim, you know, you will definitely have an out-of-body experience. But I think a lot of them just induce, you know, fairly vivid imagery rather than the stunningly realistic viewpoint that you get in what we think of as, you know, spontaneous out-of-body experience.
And the work you've done on consciousness more recently, I mean, obviously there's all the parapsychology work and looking at whether ESP exists and so on, but more recently you've returned to consciousness as a theme. Is there a relationship, I know you've touched on this to some extent already, but between the OBE research, your experiences, and the work you're doing at the moment on consciousness?
Yes, I think what happened really, perhaps oversimplifying, was that I had this extraordinary experience. I had an inquiring kind of scientific mind that wasn't going to rest until I got some answers. And I kept exploring all the things that I had been led to believe in the first place, you know, telepathy and clairvoyance and psychokinesis and ghosts and poltergeist. And, you know, I mean, kept going on and on. And it took decades to dawn on me that actually underlying all of these was the question of, well, who am I anyway? What does it mean to be a conscious human being, to feel that I exist, that I am aware of the world? What's going on? How does the brain, and of course as these decades went by, neuroscientists were learning more and more about how the brain works, how does the brain pull off this trick? Is it a trick? What's going on? That's the fundamental problem of consciousness. Or you might say the mind-body problem, the hard problem. And so in a way I now look back and think, well, those were all wrong-headed, but understandably wrong-headed attempts to get at the fundamental questions about human nature. So finally I went, okay, right, if that's what I want to do, well, I'm going to teach myself about consciousness. And that was back in around the turn of the century. And I thought, right, I'm going to give up my university job and I am going to write the first proper textbook. I mean, textbook as in a teaching book for classes, you know, textbook of consciousness. I'm going to read as much as I can possibly read in 3 years and do the book. And so that's what I did, and kind of taught myself from what was around at that time as much as I possibly could about the science of consciousness.
And that was your introduction to consciousness, isn't it? Very good.
Which has just come out in a second edition.
Very good. And what are you working on right now?
Oh, getting a life. I've worn myself out, Richard. I have just done too much and pushed myself too hard, and the meditation training, I was sort of thinking, oh well, I meditate every day, but you know, actually I think what I was doing was sort of using that almost as an excuse to pretend that I was relaxed and coping with life, and actually I'm just overwhelmed by stuff, and modern technology has made it much easier to be overwhelmed. There are, as you know more than me, millions of people out there who want to send you emails. It's all too much, so I'm actually trying to work less. And I don't have a grand project on at the moment.
Excellent. Well, thank you for finding the time to chat. A pleasure, as always. And Sue Blackmore, thank you very much for that.
No, much more fun talking to you than writing another book at the moment.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard.